Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is praying that, O son of Nanda, Tanuja Kinkaram. The word Kinkara means Kinkaroti iti Kinkara. What should I do? Kinkara is a word for servant. So I am your servant, O Lord. Patitam mam vishame bhavam budhau. In this world, somehow I have fallen. In this terrible material world, vishame bhavam budhau. Vishama is distress, distress-filled world. Krupaya tava pada pankaja. That, turn to your lotus feet. Sitadhuli sadrusham vichintaya. Please situate me at your lotus feet. This is a petition to the Lord, a call for mercy. So in this talk, I'll discuss about the relationship of endeavor and mercy in the process of bhakti. How do we start this? This one? A new one it is?
Wait, please.
Okay, sorry.
There's some EV mute.
Okay. So, you know, endeavor and prayer. So, prayer is the means by which we primarily get grace. This verse is a prayer. So, on the paths of karma and jnana, the endeavor is primary. There also, there might be some element of mercy or grace involved, but it is considered secondary. Whereas, on the path of bhakti, grace, kripa, that is primary. So, in karma also there is some idea of mercy, because say when somebody does some tapasya to invoke some devata, so Hiranyakashipu does some tapasya to please Brahma, then eventually Brahma comes and Brahma gives power, so that power we could say it is mercy. But if we see in those situations, quite often the devatas are obliged to come if the appropriate rituals are done. So in that sense, the endeavor is there, that is primary. And if the endeavor is there, then whatever blessings are there, they will automatically come. So, you know, the path of jnana, sometimes the jnanis also, they adopt some elements of bhakti. For them, bhakti is simply a tool to mukti. So, in Bengal, there is a saying, which people have, Chaitanya Path, Shankar Math. That means Chaitanya Path means follow the path of Lord Chaitanya and Shankar Math. And then go to the destination Shankaracharya has given. So the idea is, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's path of bhakti is very joyful. But they have the idea that the impersonal absolute, that is the highest realization. And I think bhakti is a means to mukti. So Chaitanya Path, Shankar Math, they have the idea. So sometimes impersonalists also practice bhakti. But they, for them, God is a not the ultimate reality. God is a transitional reality. That means I worship God till I come to the level of goodness or transcendence, and then I go beyond God. So they have the idea that we can worship God, but till we come to a higher level, and then we'll go beyond God. So in that case also, They may also, impersonals may also sometimes sing devotional songs. They may also do bhajans and kirtans. And that can be uplifting. But their goal is ultimately that we have this personal form that is there, I have to go beyond that. So in that sense, they think, how will I go beyond that? It is not by that personal form's grace. Because even that personal form is ultimately illusion. So in their case, again, their endeavor is what is primary. And that's why they do a lot of Vedantic analysis, you know. Naiti, naiti. Vedanta vakyeshu sadharamantah, it is said that. Should actually delight in the analysis of Vedanta. Trying to find out new meanings of the sutras. So there also the endeavor is primary. Now, on the path of bhakti, it is grace that is primary. So the standard example for this is like a person who is fallen in a well. Person who has fallen in the well, somebody outside wants to rescue that person. The person outside sends a rope inside. Now when the rope is sent inside, without the rope, for the person to come out is very difficult. Now try to find out some finger holds, foot holds, and try to climb up the side of the well. That is very difficult. Now the rope is there. After the rope is there, the person from outside will pull out. And the person inside has to hold on. The person inside holds on. Now in this case, if the person outside does not pull out, no matter how long the person inside holds, the person will not be able to come out. So the person outside's pulling is primary. So although the person outside's pulling is primary, that means now the pulling is like Krishna lifting us up. That's Krishna's mercy. That is primary. But at the same time, the person inside, that person also has to hold on. If the person doesn't hold on, then they will not be pulled out. So in that sense, in maths, they have something called a necessary but not sufficient condition. So in most cases, our endeavor is necessary. Although our endeavor is not sufficient, but our endeavor is necessary. So when we say grace is primary and endeavor is secondary, that does not mean endeavor is unimportant. It's like the person inside has to hold on to the rope firmly. Without that, they will not be pulled out. Srila Prabhupada says this in a CC purport, that if we are not determined, even the Supreme Personality of Godhead can't help us. So that means that the person outside, they pull out. The person outside pulls, but if the person inside is not holding, just the rope will come out. The person will stay inside only. So like that, if we don't have some determination, then even Krishna cannot help us. And Prabhupada talks about this in connection with the pastime of Kal Krishna Das. Kal Krishna Das was right with Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But although he was with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, still when he got allured and he gave into that temptation, he went away. Of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rescued him and brought him back. But still, he did have a lapse over there. So how did that happen? Although Supreme Personality of Godhead was personally with him, but still, because he became lax, he did not endeavor, so he was pulled away by Maya. So that means our determination is also important. So the role of determination is primarily to access the mercy. It is not just like the rope is there. To hold on to the rope, I need determination. Now, the determination can also be of different types. And some determination is favorable to bhakti, some determination can actually be unfavorable to bhakti. So, if the determination is an expression of devotion, or it can be an expression of willpower. Expression of willpower means, you know, yes, I show the world how sense control I am. You know, I let the whole world see how my sense control I have. And that is my primary purpose in actually controlling my senses. So say if I fast Nirjal on Ekadashi, and then when I fast Nirjal on Ekadashi, I go to the kitchen and see who all is eating what all. And I think, yeah, all sense gratifiers. So then my body is fasting, but my ego is feasting. So that sort of determination is not very favorable to bhakti. That sort of determination actually ends up making me proud. And when I become proud, I don't feel the need for Krishna. So the whole process of bhakti is that we feel a very strong need for Krishna. And pride makes us actually no longer feel any need for Krishna. So if the determination is simply an expression of our willpower, as how firmly I can stick to my resolutions, then that determination can sometimes, although we may be practicing the principles of bhakti strictly, but we may not be going closer to Krishna. So the principles of bhakti are meant to take us closer to Krishna, but we go to closer to Krishna when we have an open, humble, receptive heart. But if our heart is filled with just the idea of how sense controlled I am, how great I am, then it becomes difficult for Krishna to find a place over there. Now, in general, if we look at the six opulences, fame, wealth, power, strength, knowledge and renunciation. Among these, the last two, that is knowledge and renunciation, they are often seen as signs of spiritual advancement. If somebody is wealthy, somebody is good looking, now we won't automatically think this person must be very, very spiritually advanced. We know wealth is a result of past karma. If they are wealthy, they can use their wealth in Krishna's service. We may give some special attention to them if they are wealthy. But we don't equate wealth with spiritual advancement. We don't equate good looks, not just good in terms of passionate good looks, even a sattvic, peaceful look, we don't necessarily equate that with spiritual advancement. But quite often, jnana and vairagya, these we equate with spiritual advancement. If somebody is very renounced, we tend to think that, oh, this person must be spiritually advanced. Or if I think that if I am very renounced, and it's easy to think that I am very spiritually advanced. But here, an important thing to recognize is that just as the wealth, beauty, these are results of past karma. Some people can have them more, some people can have them less. Similarly, the capacity for renunciation is also a result of past karma. And some people may have it more, some people may have it less. Take a simple example of this is, say, with fasting. Now, if you look at it from the perspective of Ayurveda, those who have a kapha prakriti, for them fasting is relatively easy. For those who have a pitta prakriti, fasting is extremely difficult. Even fasting till noon, it starts causing so much acidity and it causes burning of the stomach, and people just can't tolerate it. Now, a person who is having kapha prakriti, they can fast nirjala also. Now, this itself is not the sign of spiritual advancement. By their past karma, they have got that bodily type in which fasting is relatively easy. And that can be used for spiritual advancement. You know, when one fasts more, one can focus on Krishna more, and one can grow spiritually. But that itself is not necessarily a sign of spiritual advancement. So different people may have different capacities for renunciation. And just like how much wealth I have doesn't determine how spiritually advanced I am. What determines how spiritually advanced I am is how I use my wealth. Just as if a person has a lot of wealth, they can do a lot of service. But the wealth will lead to spiritual advancement when it is used for service. Wealth, the presence of wealth automatically does not equate with spiritual advancement. It is when wealth is used for serving Krishna that there is spiritual advancement. So just as wealth is a result of past karma and that can be used in Krishna's service, similarly, renunciation, that is also to some extent a result of past karma, the capacity for renunciation. And just as the presence of wealth alone does not equate with spiritual advancement, similarly, the presence of renunciation alone doesn't equate with spiritual advancement. It is just as our spiritual advancement depends on not how much wealth I have, but what I do with my wealth. Similarly, our spiritual advancement depends not on how much renunciation I have, but what I do with the renunciation that I have. So if somebody has a capacity for renunciation, and if they use that capacity for renunciation to serve Krishna, you know, if people, those who can be renounced, they can avoid a lot of material entanglement, a lot of material things which dissipate a lot of our time and energy. And they can do a lot of service for Krishna. But just as wealth can be misused, similarly renunciation can be misused. So usually wealth is misused for gross sense gratification. And renunciation is misused for subtle sense gratification. So the misuse of renunciation for subtle sense gratification means that I let the renunciation feed my ego. Subtle sense gratification is puja lava pratishta. As we say that, you know, name, fame, glory, same old story. Life after life, that is what we have been doing. Chasing after name, fame, glory. So if I use my renunciation to gain name, fame, glory, then actually it is subtle sense gratification. So on the path of bhakti, when there is determination, so I'm here saying determination, I'm equating with roughly with renunciation or the capacity for renunciation. That is good, But if that is simply a product of my willpower, see how renounced I can be, then that can feed our ego. Whereas if we have renunciation, we have the capacity for renunciation, we have the capacity for determination, and we use it to focus on Krishna. We use it to become more absorbed in service of Krishna, to push aside distraction in our service to Krishna, then that determination is a very, very powerful tool on the path of bhakti. So, when we practice bhakti, our capacity for determination may vary. And that capacity for determination comes from our capacity for renunciation. And that comes from our past karma. So now, what does this mean? This means that just because somebody is necessarily more spiritual, more renounced, that does not mean that they are more advanced. They can become more advanced if they use their renunciation in Krishna's service. So now, of course, all renunciation is not necessarily a result of past karma. Because bhakti itself also produces renunciation. Vasudeve Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha, Janayatya Ashu Vairagya, Jnanam Chayadahetukam. So, in the second chapter of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it said that when there is bhakti, bhakti also leads to jnan and vairagya. So, that's why I'll talk a little bit later about judgmentality. We shouldn't be judgmental. Now, so, if somebody has renunciation, you know, it's not for us to judge whether their renunciation is a product of their devotion or whether their renunciation is coming from past karma. You know, if somebody is renounced, the traditional Vedic culture is, you know, the renounced order is respected. But that alone is not the sign of spiritual advancement. So the renunciation can also be a result of bhakti. And to some extent we see this, that initially we may have been attached to some indulgences, we might have had some undesirable habits. And we start chanting Hare Krishna, practicing bhakti, and then we're just able to give up so many things. The things which we were quite attached to earlier, when we're able to give it up, that is actually a result of Vasudeva Bhagavati. Because of bhakti, we get the higher taste, we get the higher wisdom, and we're able to give up many things. So, say now, if we consider hypothetically, there are levels of determination or levels of renunciation. If somebody's at this level, somebody's at this level. All of them have to move towards Krishna. So within Varnashram, say a person who's at a higher, more renounced level, they are considered higher than a person who's at a less renounced level. But that is the Varnashram way of looking at things. The Vaishnava way of looking at things is not how much renounced from the world I am, but how much attached to Krishna I am. And that's why we have the whole Varnashram hierarchy inverted in the discussion between Ramananda Raya and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a Brahmana and a Sannyasi, Ramananda Raya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is at the top of the Varanashram hierarchy in both ways, in Varana and Ashram. So Brahmana and Sannyasi. And Ramananda Raya is a Grahastha and a Shudra. And yet Chaitanya Mahaprabhu hears from him. So our point in discussing this is that we want determination in the practice of bhakti, but even if different devotees are capable of different levels of determination, still they all are on the progressive path. So it is not necessary that just some devotee who has greater determination is necessarily more spiritually advanced. The determination may be a result of past karma, or that greater determination can be used in Krishna's service. So once we understand this aspect, you know, we can avoid a lot of insecurity that comes when we see, oh, this devotee is doing so much, this devotee is doing so much, this devotee is so much, I can't do anything. Now, you know, in spiritual life, you know, our spiritual advancement is not a percentile score that we have to crack. You know, percentile score means that, you know, how much marks I get, that depends on how much marks everyone else is getting. It's not like that. You know, Krishna sees our heart, Krishna sees our endeavor, Krishna knows our capacity, and Krishna sees how much we are exerting according to our capacity. So, you know, whatever endeavor we are capable of, if we do it, then gradually our capacity will increase by Krishna's grace. So, we endeavor according to our capacity. And so, rather than thinking of an absolute standard of endeavor, we look at our level presently and take steps forward. take steps forward and we'll move on. And Maya can be very subtle in this connection. Sometimes, you know, we may win over temptation and go away from Krishna. And sometimes we may lose against temptation and go closer to Krishna. How is that? I may win over temptation, and if that makes me proud, I am so sense controlled. The temptation came and I resisted it. So by winning over temptation, I become proud and then I go away from Krishna. On the other hand, if I lose against temptation and that makes me feel humble, that makes me feel without Krishna, I cannot do anything. So when I realize that, then actually that may increase my dependence on Krishna. And that dependence on Krishna can actually enable me to go closer to Krishna, seek Krishna's shelter more. So in bhakti, our strengths can be our weaknesses. And our weaknesses can be our strengths. As I said this, we may win against temptation and go and not go close to Krishna. Or we may lose and go close to Krishna. So what does this first part mean, that our strengths can be our weaknesses? That is basically 1827, I think. Kunti Maharani is praying, Janma Ishvara Shruta Shribhi, Edhaman Madha Puman, Naivarhatya Vidha Tumvai Tvama Kinchana Gochara. So if my strength makes me feel that I don't need Krishna, then that becomes an impediment on the spiritual path. So thus my strength can become a weakness. On the other hand, my weakness, my inability to do certain things, if that makes me more humble, that makes me feel the need for Krishna, then my weakness can become my strength. That can make me feel more urgently the need for Krishna, and that can take us closer to Krishna. So we may win against temptation and not go close to Krishna, or we may lose and go close to Krishna. So the endeavor is important, but there is no, rather than looking at endeavor in an absolute standard, we can see what is my level and endeavor to the best of my capacity. So I said that in our grace is primary, but endeavor, although secondary, it is not unimportant. Endeavor is also necessary. And then we discuss elaborately about what the role of endeavor is. So last point I'll conclude, and we can have some question answers here. So we are unqualified, but we are never disqualified. So what this means is, unqualified means we actually have no qualification to receive Krishna's mercy. But disqualified means, now you're not allowed to participate only. Like say some, in listen to the Olympics, some athletes were found that they had taken some drugs. So if they are accused in doping, then they are not allowed to participate itself. They are disqualified. So in bhakti, we are never disqualified. We are unqualified, but we are never disqualified. Always Krishna keeps the doors to him open for us. From wherever we are, no matter how much we fall, the path to Krishna is always open. And in that sense, no matter what happens, even if we fail in our endeavors repeatedly, still, if we keep focused in trying to go towards Krishna, we will eventually move towards him and we will attain him. And this is actually the mood of 9.30 and 31, where Krishna says, Apichet Suduracharo Bhajate Mamananya Bhak Sadhureva Samantavya Samyak Vyavasito Hisaha. Even if somebody commits terrible wrong activities, if they are devoted to me, then they are well situated. Krishna says they are to be considered saintly. What this means is, yesterday I talked about spikes. Sometimes the spikes come and that time they are just overpowered. So what Krishna is saying here, basically in the time, in terms of the spike metaphor, that when there are spikes, we may do something wrong, Suduracharo. But after that, Bhajate Mamananya Vaka. One is determined to continue practicing bhakti. One doesn't think because I fell down, so I'll give up bhakti only. continues on, that eventually we will become purified by the practice of bhakti. So that's the first one. We are never disqualified, no matter how low level our endeavor may be. We can always receive Krishna's mercy. We are not disqualified. And then our endeavor doesn't generate mercy. But our endeavor attracts mercy. What is the difference between generating and attracting? Generating means, say, if I go to some food booth and then I put some money and then food booth, some food pops out. So I have put in the money and the food has come out. So we can say the money input has generated that food. That is generation. But endeavor means what? There is a beggar on the street. And then that beggar begs to the passer, please give me some food, please give me some money. Now, if the beggar begs very fervently, a passerby may feel more inspired to give. But the begging itself does not entitle the beggar to get the alms, to get the charity. So, the more fervently the beggar begs, the likelihood of the person giving charity is more. Giving alms is more, but it's not necessary. So, Prabhupada gave the example that once he was going on a morning walk and there were some ducks who were being fed by a man. And Prabhupada was observing that the man was giving some food to all the different ducks. And there was one duck that was quacking especially loudly. Very loudly it was quacking, quacking, quacking. And then this man was giving more morsels to that duck. So Prabhupada said it like that. He says, we call out to Krishna for mercy more and more. This man could give the duck morsels to anyone. But this duck was calling out more and the man was giving more food. So like that he says, the mercy, we call out to Krishna more. Our endeavor doesn't generate. It can't force Krishna to give mercy. But our endeavor attracts Krishna's mercy. The more we endeavor, the more Krishna will give mercy to us. So it is not a linear proportion. Krishna, as there's a whole concept of Kripa Siddha also. Some people may get elevated and become perfect just by mercy. But general process is Sadhana Siddha. We do Sadhana and then Krishna gives Kripa. And that's how we move onwards in our spiritual journey. So this prayer is a prayer for mercy. Kripaya tava pada pankaja sthita dhuli sadrusham vichinte. Please situate me at your lotus feet. So now, what does it mean to be situated on Krishna's lotus feet? Basically, if we look at the context, this verse is saying that please lift me out of material existence. Now, I've fallen this vishame bhavam buddhau, terrible material existence I have fallen. Please lift me out of this. And it can also, at our level, it can mean, you know, lift me out of material consciousness and lift me to spiritual consciousness. And all the previous verses, if we see the flow that is going, first it describes how powerful the holy name is. The second verse talks about, oh yes, further explanation of the power of the holy name and the misfortune in not being attracted to the holy name. The third verse talks about how to become attracted to the holy name. And the fourth verse talks about the aspiration. That, no, I don't want anything of this world. I want only Krishna. And in the fifth verse says, okay, I'm in this world where all these things are Dhanajana, Sundari, Kavita, all these are there. But I don't want these things. So please lift me out of this world. Lift me out of this world and please situate me at your lotus feet. So being situated at Krishna's lotus feet means being situated in devotional consciousness, absorbed in devotional consciousness. And 6th, 7th, 8th texts will actually talk about that devotional consciousness. The deep spiritual emotions that come in this devotional consciousness, the transformations of ecstasy, that all will be talked about in the subsequent verses. That's how I said that the first five verses are talking about the sambandha in one sense. The whole is prayojan, but now later on it will talk, the whole is abhideya, and the last three verses will be about prayojan. So the sambandha gyan, that actually Krishna is my only desirable object and Krishna is so potent that he can elevate me. So what I want is, I want to be elevated. So that means, I just want to give another way of analyzing this, is that, you know, when a person goes for begging, you know, begging is essentially a relationship of asymmetry. In other words, people want symmetrical relationship. Both of us are equals. But begging is inherently a relationship of asymmetry. The beggar doesn't have anything. And the donor has so much. And then donor gives to the beggar. You know, if a beggar goes with in a suit and pant and has suitcases and has a wallet with filled with money, and the beggar says, give me some money. Well, why do you need money? You already have it. Why should I give it to you? So begging is a relationship of asymmetry. In begging, what would a beggar normally do? Beggar will glorify the donor about how wealthy they are, how charitable they are. And then the beggar will talk about, oh, what a fallen condition I am in. No, I am so poor. I have not eaten for so long. I am dying of starvation. Or my relatives are very sick and whatever it is. They'll talk about their destitute condition. And then say, please give me some alms. So basically, if you analyze, begging will have these three parts. Not necessarily a linear sense. But how great the donor is. That means how wealthy and how charitable the donor is. How destitute I am. And please, therefore, help me. So if you look at it that way, these verses, the first two verses are glorifying how great Krishna's holy name is. How great Krishna's holy name is. Now, first verse talks literally about the various ways in which it is filled with nectar, it frees from material existence and all that. Second verse also talks this further, that actually all of Krishna's power is there in the holy name. So there, the glorification of Krishna, that is like the praising of the donor is happening. Then he talks about his own disqualification in that same verse. Unfortunately, I have no taste for the holy name. I have no taste for the holy name. And then this, what is saying is, okay, then how does one develop taste? That is, through humility and tolerance, by that one can develop taste. And by trying to reject material desires and select spiritual desires. But all this, you know, cultivating humility and tolerance, you know, cultivating rejection of worldly desires, all that is actually very difficult to sustain when you are in material consciousness. So therefore, this verse has the prayer, please raise me to spiritual consciousness. I am a spiritual being, I am your eternal part, please lift me up. So in that way, expressing the glory of the holy name, expressing one's destitute condition, and then begging to be elevated up. That's how the Shikshashtakam is flowing forwards. And the last three verses will describe that once one is elevated, what are the emotions that the soul in spiritual consciousness experiences? So, any comments or questions? Yes, Rum.
You were describing Krishna's, you know, like, extending mercy by how much we call him out. Let's say from a devil's advocate point of view, one can say, well, okay, Krishna is like partial, because unless you call out, he doesn't extend. What if someone may have a good intention, but they're just not the type of person to call out? Then maybe Krishna won't extend mercy. So can you explain how, from Krishna's point of view, how that works?
Okay. So is Krishna partial? Because only when we call out, he responds. And if somebody doesn't have the nature to call out, then will Krishna not respond? See, firstly, Krishna is impartially partial. What that means is, he is definitely partial. He says, there's no doubt, he says, I give so much mercy to my devotees. Muktim dadati karichit nasma bhakti yogam. I give liberation to my devotees, not to others. So Krishna's partiality is definitely there. But then he's impartial because he opens the doors for devotion to everyone. So I'll explain this. What I mean by this, that Krishna is impartially partial. So Krishna is partial in the sense that he favors his devotees. And there's no denying. The scriptures talk so much about how he favors his devotees. But he's impartial in the sense that he opens the doors of devotion to everyone. So I'll give two examples to illustrate this. Going back to the earlier example of how a beggar is there and a donor is there. So now, suppose that donor, they want to give charity to everyone. Like what Prabhupada said, you know, we would like that around our temples, 10 miles around, that no one should go hungry. So now the donor may give charity to everyone, but it may be that in near their own home, that donor may be especially charitable. Now, I'll give money to everyone, but in this area, I want to make sure, at least in this area, I want to have around my home, I want to have a hunger-free zone. So now if the donor also makes it clear, anybody can come and stay here. If you stay here, I'll take care of your food. So he's partial in the sense that he's not giving so much charity to everyone. But he's impartial in the sense that he's allowing everyone to come and stay there. So similarly, Krishna, he is partial to his devotees, but he's impartial in the sense that he opens the doors of devotion to everyone. So now coming specifically to the point of somebody may not have the nature to call out. So calling out is not just a matter of literally raising our hands and calling out. Yes, that is also calling out. But that is not the only means. You know, we can call out through our endeavors also. That means that if somebody is very diligently doing some service, then that also is a way we can attract Krishna's attention. So calling out doesn't depend on the volume with which I am chanting. Calling out is actually more a call of the heart than the call of the tongue. So for some people, it may be true that some people are, you know, maybe a little more introvert. So for them, you know, loud kirtans, they just find it a little, they can't relate with it so much. They feel a little shy to do that. Now, of course, sankirtan is our process and we follow that. But sometimes people who are too conscious of others, they cannot express their heart too much among many people. So it may be that kind. Then they may pray to Krishna when the crowds are less. They may go in front of the deities and pray. I'm saying the point I'm making is there is always room for individuality in bhakti. There is a standard process, but within the standard process, there is room for adaptation. If we look at the five Pandavas, now all of them are singular individuals. Each of them is so different. They're all serving Krishna, but they're different. So that individuality is there. So in terms of being very expressive, if we think of calling out simply as being very expressive in calling out, that may not be in the nature for everyone. But calling out in terms of a call of the heart, which different people may express in different ways, that is fine. So for some people, this I'll talk a little bit more about this in the next verse when we talk about sentimentality. For some people, you know, I'll elaborate it later only, but quickly I'll just mention that for some people, the emotions may not come very quickly. They may be a little more reserved. So those emotions, which is just not that, just because for some people emotions come very quickly, that does not mean that they are calling out to Krishna more earnestly. It may not be like that. It can be like that, it may not be like that. So we'll talk about emotions a little bit later. But the important thing is, bhakti is inclusive. Now, whatever be our psychophysical nature, within that we can connect with Krishna. So our calling out to Krishna may not be all that expressive in terms of external gestures. But if we at least recognize that I need Krishna's mercy and I will strive for Krishna's mercy, then that is what we need to do. Does it answer your question? Yes. Yes, Karan.
I really like this quote of we are unqualified, but we are never disqualified.
Mm.
We also mentioned about Kala Krishnadas, who was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's servant. He did mistake only once when he was attracted by Bhattacharis, but Mahaprabhu actually took him away from his service.
Okay. Yeah. So when I said we are never disqualified, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu almost like rejected Kala Krishnadas when he committed just one mistake. See, when we say we are never disqualified, that does not mean that we are qualified for any and every form of service. Now, certain services may require certain standards. And if the standards are not followed, then it may not be appropriate for somebody to take up that service. So if you see, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejected him to set an example. You know, that he wanted somebody who is with him to be exemplary. But what happened is, the devotees engaged him. Nityanand Prabhu, and practically all the devotees had a, had you, in today's language you call it, they had an emergency meeting. You know, they called everyone, even Parmanand Puri came over there, and Parmanand Puri, they all talked and they decided, you know, engage in some other way. And they told that, you have been traveling to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, please go and to Mayapur and tell the devotees what all Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. And then he got that service. And then they told Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that we are sending him. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not forbid that. He just heard it and he left it over there. So it is true that if somebody is in a major leadership position and then they have some fall, then it's not that the fall is inconsequential. See, from the ultimate perspective of practicing bhakti, the fall is inconsequential. They can always rise and start practicing bhakti again. But from the social perspective in this world, you know, if there is a fall, there are consequences of that. And the consequences mean that we have to actually, certain people may not be, it may not be appropriate for them to do certain services. So that is understood. So what, see, our decisions or our situations, they may disqualify us for certain services, certain specific services. But the principle of connecting with Krishna, that is something which no one can stop us. Does that answer the question? Any other questions? Yes, please. Yes, Prabhu. Yeah.
Yesterday, you were mentioning related to today, and I was trying to put together in my mind that you said when the wrongdoing things happen in relation place, then guilt should not come between you and Krishna. It should come in between wrongdoing and you, so then the wall will protect you.
Correct. Yeah.
So, and then you explained that if we don't have in between Krishna, then we can appeal. And
yeah.
Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur's song, that he took shelter, he said
yeah.
he's bad. So now I'm putting together on today's that it seems like a lot of householders or including me, those who are not in a position, to be honestly, to pray that oi nand na dhanam na janam na sundari, we are the one that I really don't feel like everybody feel to genuinely pray that I want only you. So maybe my understanding is that the attraction for those things separately from Krishna consciousness is what we are addressing there.
Okay, yeah, very good question, very good point also actually. See, is it that this Nadhanam Janam Sundarim, can it be applied to everyone, especially those in householder life? They are going to have these things. Wealth is especially required, and other things are also a part of householder life. Yeah, so there is the aspiration for pure devotion, but there is also a process towards going to that level of pure devotion. And what we need to do is follow the process. So, just like an example, like once I was giving a one devotee gave a class, and then this devotee was saying, you know, we should think that we can die at any moment. Today might be my last day. This moment might be last moment. The roof may fall and I may die. Now, the devotee's whole class was, you know, basically all imaginative ways of describing how we will die at the next moment. You know, then one devotee, he asked a question, Prabhu, if I think that I'm going to die today, I'll think, why should I go to my office? Let me just stay in the temple and chant. So can I do it through the rest of my life? What does it mean practically? See, sometimes one aspect may be too overemphasized. Okay, it's possible that I may die today. But the point is that what can I do if I'm going to die today? I have to absorb myself in Krishna. And there is a process for absorbing oneself in Krishna. And that process is the process of Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga involves various ashrams, and then whatever ashram I am in, I do my duties according to that ashram and I will move onwards. So it is not that just because I am going to die, that means I give up all activities and just start focusing only on Krishna. That's not what I should be doing if I am in the grihastha ashram or whatever situation I am in. So the important thing is, whenever we hear any such a very, like the idea that death may come any time, or when we hear of Nadhanam Nadhanam Sundarim, this is This is a principle. So in the case of another, so in case of death, it is talking about how in this world everything can be destroyed. Therefore, we should go towards Krishna. In the case of nadhanam na janam na sundarim, the idea is that, oh, I just don't want anything else, I want only Krishna, which is an advanced state of devotion, towards which we want to go. But either irrespective of whether we want to go away from the material world or go towards Krishna, there is a process to be followed. And it is only by following that process that we can get there. So, we accept the principle of selfless devotion of only desiring only Krishna. But at our present level, we are not at that level. So, as you rightly said, as devotees, what we should be doing is, Krishna should be our strongest desire. That means we cannot be at the level where Krishna is our only desire. But Krishna should be our strongest desire. That means it becomes a competition between Krishna and wealth. Then it is not that I'll give up Krishna and go after wealth. So I may need the other things and I may have to get the other things also. But I will not give up Krishna for these things. And as much as possible, I will try to integrate my journey towards Krishna with the pursuit of these things. And that is actually the Vedic path, you know, dharma, artha, kama and moksha. So artha and kama, basically that means these are purusha arthas which are on the way towards ultimately getting moksha. Now of course bhakti is higher than moksha, but I am talking about the progression that is there. So in artha and kama, dhana and jana sundari, all these are included. So it's not that when we have an aspiration, we aspire for something, that does not mean that we can immediately act on that level. So the practical thing that we can do is, we can make Krishna our foremost desire. Just like I may say I am not the body, but you know, I cannot stop acting at the body level right now. So and that is not what Krishna also expects. If you see Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, 2.13 says that you are not the body, dehi nosmi nithade. But right in the next verse, 2.14, Krishna refers to Arjuna using two bodily designations. Matra sparshastu Kaunteya, son of Kunti. If I am not the body, then how am I the son of Kunti? He could ask, you know. Shitoshtu sukhadukka daha agam apayino nityas tam sitiksha swabharata. Well, if I am not the body, how am I a descendant of the Bharata dynasty? So Prabhupada explains there in the purport that actually these indicate that he is connected with exalted people, and therefore exalted lineage brings with it a responsibility to act properly. So in principle, I accept that I am not the body. But in practice, I have to live in my relationship with my body. So then, these bodily relationships, they can inspire us to practice dharma. So Arjuna, yes, to act at the spiritual level or to act in a way by which you can get spiritual realization, that is not easy. But, you know, you are coming in a great dynasty. Therefore, you can do this great thing. So basically, our bodily designations, whichever they may be, they can be used to inspire us to go towards Krishna. We cannot suddenly reject all bodily designation. So similarly, bodily needs, bodily desires, they can be accommodated within the frame of bhakti. Does it answer your question? Yes, Mata. Yeah.
And discussing bhakti and how bhakti progresses through that. So is there any direct connection between the eight levels of bhakti, like Shraddha, Sankhya, first one, Sangha, first two?
Oh. I don't think I've heard anything like that. How are they? Those levels?
What's the question?
The question is that whether the stages of bhakti, Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya, are they related with bhakti? They're related with the verses of Shikshashtakam. I have not seen anything like that. And in one sense, we could... this is more of a individual meditation. And it's more of an individual meditation. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is in his own trance, he's absorbed in Krishna. So, that is more of a overall process with specific limbs within it. So, it's like just in Shikshashtakam, you're not going to talk about, say, you should drink Charanamrit or you should worship the deity. Those are limbs of bhakti, but this is more of a evolution in terms of the evolution of consciousness. So it is not talking so much about specific aspects of bhakti. It's talking more about the evolution of consciousness. Okay, you wanted to add something?
Yeah,
I heard Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur on Bhaktivedanta Swamiji also saying that when someone in the gradual progression after took a strong vow, nista, that he started tasting it, then this nadhanam najanam is applicable because he actually feels very disgusted, this distaste of his involvement in sanctification. He regrets.
Okay. I think that can be correlated, yes. Nadhanam najanam sundarim will be, at that level we can say is connected with the nishthit bhajana kriya. So, shraddha, sadhu, sangha, bhajana kriya, anartha nivritti, and nishtha. So, basically, when there is anartha nivritti, then one can actually be at the level of nadhanam najanam nasundari. So, that we can say is the nishthit bhajana kriya, which is also called as nishtha. And then from there onwards, we can go to the higher stages. Thank you. Yes, Prabhu.
You explained about sadhana siddha and kripa siddha. To me, it seems like everything is kripa siddha. How much sadhana one can do to get Krishna's mercy? The story of Ramanujacharya traveling with his followers, he washed his hands in a river and then one fish got 400 forms and went to Vaikuntha. Other followers complained that we have been with you for so long, we are not getting that form. How that fish? I did not fully understand the explanation for that. Can you answer that?
Okay. So, ultimately, isn't everything a matter of kripa only? Now, when we talk about differentiating between kripa siddha and sadhana siddha,
just to,
yeah, I'm repeating the question. So there is Ramacharya's story where he just washed his hands and some fish, they got the water which was filled with his Mahaprasad, and they took that and they got Vaikuntha forms. They were liberated, and his disciples, they said, we have been serving you and still we are in the material world. So yeah, so how is it? Is it that sadhana at all matters, or is it simply kripa that matters? Yeah, there are, in different contexts, different things that are emphasized. And we cannot take one particular pastime or one particular quote from scripture and make that an absolute principle. So, like yesterday, I gave the example. The Bhagavad Gita is focusing more on engaged bhakti, engaging in this world. Because that is what Arjuna that is what is required for Krishna's cause of establishing dharma. That's what Krishna wants Arjuna to do. On the other hand, the Bhagavatam talks more about renounced bhakti. Because Parikshit Maharaj is at the end of his life, and forum focuses on just wholehearted absorption in Krishna. So the context determines quite a lot. And certain pastimes may stress one aspect. Other pastimes may stress another aspect. So, what is stressed in one aspect, when one particular pastime, we can look at the principle of that, not make that an absolute in itself. So, if we see that way, we could say ultimate, it's all mercy, that it's only by mercy that we get elevated, we get liberated. But then, we see even the acharyas themselves and their followers, they have worked very hard. And you know, it is appreciated. Prabhupada was once asked that, do you love all your disciples equally? And Prabhupada said, yes. But if someone comes forward to take responsibility, I reciprocate. Someone come forward to take responsibility, I reciprocate. So that is natural. It's like, say, there's a father, there's a lot of property, and the father has several children. The father wants to give the property to all the children. But there might be some one child who is just like a loafer, just wasting money and going out here and there. The other son may be helping the father in the business. Now, naturally, the father wants to give everything to his children, but a son who is assisting the son, father practically in the management of the business, management of the home, taking responsibility, naturally the father will have more affection. So, we have to recognize that Krishna has a mission in this world also. That Krishna wants to have his message broadcast, Krishna wants to have people attracted in this world. And that requires endeavor. So, now, we see also Krishna says that those who broadcast this message, they are very dear to me. So, our endeavor is something which is pleasing to Krishna. Because when we are willing to endeavor, then we become more usable instruments in Krishna's hands. Because if I am not ready to endeavor, then Krishna cannot use me much. So if I want to become a teacher or I want to become a preacher, yes, it is Krishna has to bless me, but at the same time I have to study scripture, I have to understand the concepts, and then I can be used by Krishna. So we cannot just neglect the role of endeavor in pleasing Krishna and in enabling us to become instruments in his hands. So, and that if Krishna is pleased, if we assist him in his mission, naturally Krishna will reciprocate and bless us. So in certain situations, certain pastimes are often given to highlight certain things. So that particular pastime of Ramanujacharya, just taking his Mahaprasad, fish taking his Mahaprasad and getting elevated. What that indicates is the extraordinary potency of an Acharya's mercy. Of the association of Acharya, the mercy of Acharya, how extraordinarily potent that it is. But yesterday also, I think day before yesterday I mentioned that we should not see the extraordinary as a substitute for the ordinary. Because I'm like Ajamil chanted once and got liberated, therefore I'll also chant once and I'll expect liberation. No, we see the extraordinary not as a substitute for the ordinary process of bhakti, but rather as an inspirer for practicing the ordinary process with greater devotion. So in some extraordinary situations, mercy can elevate and liberate. But what we see is, when we see the potency of mercy over there, we become more inspired to practice the standard process of bhakti, by which we can actually assist Krishna in his mission, and Krishna will grant his mercy to us. Does it answer your question?
To a good extent. I see that every statement in scripture must be true. It is true. It's just that we have to find the right explanation to connect them.
Correct.
So here it's not fully understandable that how Krishna is impartial also. At the same time, there is Kripasiddha phenomena happening, there is a Sadhana Siddha phenomena happening. And there must be something more tying them together. Is the Kripasiddha as an advertisement for the Sadhana Siddha to be followed? That it's the last stage, that somebody has followed the enough Sadhana and this is the last stage that we are seeing in that event?
Okay.
That has undergone.
So, how is Krishna impartial if he offers Kripa Siddhi to some and then he asks others to do sadhana to get Siddhi? Yeah. See, at one level, if we are going to talk about Krishna's partiality, then we can talk about in the spiritual world also. You know, there is one in India, there is a spiritual teacher who gave big talk that does God have favorites? Basically, the idea is that politicians have favoritism. They have their own favorites. So God has no favorites. God is impartial to all. Now that is true for Krishna as the Paramatma. That is not true for Krishna as Bhagwan. For Krishna, Radharani is his favorite gopi. So God also has his favorites. You know, Krishna loves all flowers, Krishna loves all of nature, but he puts a peacock feather on his face. No, Krishna likes all instruments, but he plays a flute. So God has his personal nature. And personal nature will also mean personal preferences. So there's no meaning to personal nature if there are no personal preferences involved in it. So if we try to superimpose on Krishna the conception of impartiality in this world, then basically Krishna will be left with no personality only. Isn't it? Because every personal choice is a preference for something, and preference for one thing means not preferring the other thing, isn't it? So here, how is this possible that Krishna is a person with his own preferences and at the same time, he is impartial, he is universally accessible? That is by Krishna's omnipotence. That means that, say there are different gopis, and some gopis are very intimately connected with Krishna, some gopis are serving Krishna from a distance. So in our tradition, we follow the manjaris. So the gopis perform leela with Krishna and the manjaris observe Krishna perform leela with the gopis and the manjaris get ecstasy. Now Acharyas describe that actually by observing the leela of Krishna with the gopis, the manjaris get not The same amount of ecstasy, but the Manjari sometimes get more ecstasy also. So how is that? That is Krishna's omnipotence. So at a level of at the level of God as a person, he will have his preferences, and that's what makes his personality concrete, real. But if we think of God only as a person, God is a person, but he's an omnipotent person. So Krishna can be performing Leela with Radharani, but he can be manifesting at the same time in the heart of another gopi who is not in the Leela so close to Krishna. And that way that gopi also gets enriched by Krishna's presence. So in that sense, we cannot impose material conceptions of partiality on Krishna. So what we understand is that in some exceptional cases, Krishna may give kripa siddhi to some people. But the important thing is, Krishna remains accessible to everyone. And if we practice bhakti, he will also give us his mercy. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, Prabhupada. Anyone else who has not asked till now? Okay, yes, Prabhupada.
Can we see in the same example of Ramanujacharya?
Yeah.
Can we see it from a different angle that, okay, his disciples actually get more mercy in that they get the opportunity to serve in a greater way?
Oh.
Just like Lord Ramachandra, when he left, Hanuman behind for service. So in a sense, you can understand that Hanuman gets more mercy than all the other Ayodhyavasis who went back with him. And we see things in that way.
Yeah, that's also a nice way of looking at it. So, can you say that Ramacharya's associates, they are getting the opportunity to serve, and the fish are not getting that opportunity. So, in that sense, they are also getting special mercy. Yes, there is that very beautiful pastime of Prabhupada with one of his servants. I don't remember, was it? Basically, you know, wherever Prabhupada would go, the devotees would be receiving at the airport, dancing in kirtan, and many of them would have tears. And Prabhupada would arrive, they would be in tears. When Prabhupada would be leaving, they would be in tears. Servant of Prabhupada, he asked Prabhupada, you know, all these devotees, they have so much bhakti for you that they are in tears just by seeing you. Prabhupada, I am always with you, but I am never in tears. I don't get any tears at all. Prabhupada just smiled and he said, but you are serving me. So you are serving me. So tears are nice. We'll talk about sentiments in the next talk. But the important thing is, our relationship with Krishna is based on service. So, you know, if we think of liberation only as the essence of liberation is not just a relocation. You know, it is not that somehow if somebody gets into the spiritual world, they are liberated. Yeah, you know, if somebody is not having the disposition to serve, in the spiritual world they will be miserable. What to do? Everybody is serving Krishna, everybody is talking about Krishna. Suppose, say, now the soccer season is going on and suddenly we find ourselves in a soccer stadium. And, you know, everybody is talking about soccer and we have no interest in soccer. We'll feel bored over there. What to do here, isn't it? So like that, if somehow we are taken to the spiritual world, but if you have not developed attraction to Krishna, we'll be out of place over there. But if you have developed a disposition to serve Krishna, then even in this world also we can experience Krishna. And then as we go back to the spiritual world, so basically liberation is more a change of disposition than a change of location. It's not just going from here to there. It is actually turning our heart from this world to Krishna. More a change of disposition than a change of location. And that change of disposition is what happens by our practice of bhakti. So thank you very much. We will meet at 11:35 in 20 minutes. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.